Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming. And there's going to be a little bit of chatting between myself and Jeff, and then he's going to go to the piano and play some songs for us, and then back to some more chatting and more song, and then back to me to explain a little bit more about Jesus. And there will be a chance for Q&A at the end, so do think of your thorniest questions that you can hurl at Jeff and see how he does at them. But I thought I'd ask you, Jeff, what was the first album or first single that you ever bought?
Okay, we were chatting about this earlier. I worked out my big sister used to get me to buy albums with her. We have to pay 50, you know, like pay half each. So I was buying Beatles albums when I was about 7, I think. So I think I got a rough end of the deal with that. My first album I bought was Bridge Over Troubled Waters by Simon and Garfunkel.
Wow, that's good taste, isn't it?
Yeah, that was my first.
Yeah.
That I bought for myself.
Very good. And,
yeah.
And when you listened to that, was it like, what did music do to you? Did you have an experience of first kind of hearing something and thinking, this is magic?
Yeah. I guess perhaps like some here, I was packed off to do like music lessons. I learnt the piano. And so I think, and I kind of like that. That was good. Mm-hmm. But some of these things, for the first time, it was, wow, that's really interesting. And, oh, right, someone's doing this sort of thing. And so I think, you know, yeah, so each album or whatever, I guess, was like another world of, like, songs and sounds and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And favourite bands growing up? Who did you listen to?
Oh, I mean, I was the generation that would have remembered the Beatles and stuff, so, I mean, some of that stuff, Beatles, the role... You know, when I was a kid... they were the problem. I mean, when I was having a piano, you know, I was supposed to be doing my piano practice and I'd be trying to sort of play a Beatles song or something.
Right.
And I'd be, oi, get on me a piano. Oh, yeah, sorry. You know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, if you were around at that time, it was hard not to be influenced by, you know, the excitement of all that.
Did you always want to be a rock star?
Well, okay, I mean, I did grow up in North London. I don't know anyone's from that neck of the woods. I mean, I grew up in suburban North London. To a certain extent, people didn't become rock stars. I mean, people had proper jobs. So kind of, there was something in me that thought, you know, music's important, I'd like to, but at the same time, I suppose I still did my exams and went off to college and did some of that sort of stuff.
So you never would have imagined yourself to be on stage in Glastonbury when you were...
Not particularly, 15? No, I don't think I did. I think I just knew I enjoyed music and I was going to go with the flow, but I wasn't sort of, from the age of 15, that's going to be, because I, to a certain extent, wasn't what was around me. Certainly in those days.
So then how did you get into it? What was your big break?
The big break. Well, I guess, as I said, I played sort of piano as a kid. I started to listen to different stuff. When I was sort of in my sort of late teens, early 20s, there was a couple of local bands that I played in. We were going to be the next sort of big thing, you know. We were sort of... But I suppose it was... listening to different sorts of music that kicked it off for me. Do any of you from North London? Do any of you guys here know North Londoners? Vaguely. Okay. I had grandparents in Edmonton and there was Edmonton Market. And when I was in my sort of mid-teens, there was a record store there. And I remember buying a blues sampler album. It was this blues album. It had all different sorts of things. And it was things like that that started to make me think I really enjoyed music. I'm going to play something.
Go on then.
Shall I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do it.
I'm going to do this. So this was on that album. I'm not going to sing, by the way. The song I'm going to play. This is a little piece on a blues sample. This is by a guy called Mead Lux Lewis. And this is called the Honky Tonk Train Blues, which I thought, I quite like that. Here it goes. This is it. Thank you. I'm afraid Mead Lux Lewis got killed in a car crash in 1967 in Detroit. So that's where it got him writing that. So yeah, I guess.
Way to bring down a room, Jeff.
Yeah, yeah. We were all clapping along.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Ride that wave. So, go on.
Well, that was the sort of stuff. I mean, hearing that sort of thing, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is the sort of stuff I'd like to sort of play. Mm. So, professional music.
So, professional music. What was your first gig? Like, how did you really break into it?
Professionally, or. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My first gig was with my my family had a friend, and this guy used to work in the Chingford United Services Club, and he got me to come and play with him when I was about 19, I guess. It was my first. He said, "You'll get paid for this." Okay. So he said, "Right." And what this guy used to do, he played guitar. He used to take great pleasure in starting songs without telling me the name of the song or what key it was in. So we go. And also the other thing this guy did, he could do whole songs without knowing any of the words.
Right.
He would go, he'd go, up that lazy river with a van on the wing. Up that lazy river on the sea, on the sea. And then they'd play bingo. So we'd have to stop for the bingo. And then a guy would come around selling like prawns. And so that was my first sort of gig. But okay. He ducked out of that and he said, look, find yourself a guitarist and you can come. So I met a mate. Yeah. And then we formed a band in North London and we did a late 70s indie single. We did our own single. We did a version of Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones. And you did everything 100 miles an hour. I see a red door ran. I want it. Paint It Black. Oh, no, no, no. It was dead fast. And so we did that.
So punk is kind of starting at this sort of stage?
Yeah.
It's around. So
yeah, punk, late 70s. And I guess there was that whole power pop energy thing. Yeah. So everything we did was 100 mile an hour.
Yeah.
And I guess I had proper jobs, but, you know, I'd come in from work and then I'd go rushing off and we'd go and do a gig. But it didn't really go anywhere. And I was working for a record. I got a sort of job with a record company because I thought that's kind of quite interesting. And I was in the press office and I saw the band had sort of split, man. That wasn't really happening. And I saw this ad in the back of Melody Maker because I don't know if you remember, Melody Maker used to have all the classified ads. If you wanted to buy guitars or gigs and stuff, it was all in Melody Maker. And there was a sort of box ad and I recognized the phone number as Phonogram Records because I kind of worked in the press office. I thought, hang on, that's Phonogram's number. Keyboard player needed. All right, so I phoned up, and it was basically a band called the Teardrop Explodes who'd signed to Phonogram and instantly sort of split up and sort of all fell apart. Mm-hmm. So they needed another keyboard player. Mm-hmm. And I went along, and we had a bit of a play and met the band, and it kind of worked out. So, yeah, this is good. We want to go. So then I signed the contract. It was a sort of... You know, I was a fully contracted member of the band with all the legal stuff, and off we went. Mm-hmm. And we just released a single, which, started sort of doing okay. We started rehearsing just before we were going to go to America. It was got to number 45 in the charts. So we were at number 45 in the charts, and we got, I don't know, the guys used to watch Top of the Pops. Yeah, Thursday night, Top of the Pops. Well, you'll probably remember there was always a sort of record that was just outside. There would always be the sort of something in the 40s that would be, you know. So we were that week, and so right, Top of the Pops. And for me, this was going on. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, I'd been playing in pub bands, and then got involved in this thing. And suddenly we're doing Top of the Pops. So we all went to, there was a place in Euston called Lawrence Corner. It was an army surplus shop. So we were all dressed up in all this sort of camo gear and camouflage gear. And, you know, I had the Dutch army boots and these trousers. And I had this headband around my head. I mean, I was
and
making
we've got
a statement.
Footage of it, right? Yeah. No, we don't actually.
Well,
wouldn't you want that?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want that?
Hey, look, YouTube, top, Teardrop Explodes, reward. You'll see the headband, the nodding dog. I was making a statement, but I can't remember what the statement was. But I mean, so we did that, And I guess if you remember Top of the, I mean, kind of overnight, if you've been on Top of the Pops, I mean, I used to sit and watch it with my mum and dad, everybody, the next day, everybody's heard of the band. Yeah. Really, you know, I mean, yeah. Crumbs, you were on Top of the, prior to that, we were a kind of NME fodder, you know, the Trendies knew about all these new bands that were bubbling around. You do Top of the Pops. So you were never on Top of the Pops 2 weeks running. You couldn't, you had to, you know, you had to go up 2 weeks in the, on the trot, as it were. We went off to America for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. as you do, played. And then when we came back, we were number six in the charts.
Wow.
So we did Top of the Pops again, and we were, yeah, so.
And how old are you at this stage?
That's a very personal question.
At this stage? I'm not going to say how many years ago.
No. Do
and
the maths.
How much do you weigh?
Do the maths. No. I was 25, 26.
25, 26.
Yeah.
Wow. This is dream come true type territory, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, if you're doing that sort of pop stuff,
yeah.
then, yeah, to get the opportunity to do, I mean, do you remember Jackie Magazine? Does anyone remember Jackie Magazine? Put your hand up. Can I just see a shot? Does anyone remember Jackie? There's a few people, Jackie. Well, we were on the center pages of Jackie. I was a center page pinup in Jackie Magazine. The downside of that is that I was the bloke who had the staples through me.
Ah. Yeah.
So, you know, everything that gives you one hand, take with another.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, we were getting some of the sort of trappings of all that stuff.
And you started to tour with them, and you told me earlier that you did a double header with U2 in New York. Is that right?
Yeah.
You both got equal billing?
We did both get equal billing, yeah. They were on last, though, so I've got a feeling that they probably topped it.
Yeah.
But, well, it was quite a big change for me because the first gig I did with the band, the first gig was in America, in upstate New York, big club. We played the gig, you know, we finished, it went well. And I naturally, we'd sort of finished, I probably grabbed a drink or something, wandered back out onto the sort of stage, a couple of guys who were working with us as well, and started sort of dismantling the keyboards. Mm. You know, and this guy came over and he said, Jeff, what are you doing? I said, well, you know, breaking down the keyboards. He said, well, look, no, I do that. Right. You know, you just go and sit down and go and have a beer or something and sort of, oh, right, you know, this is good.
You've got roadies.
Yeah,
now.
I've got roadies. They've got.
Wow.
So, yeah, so the band, there was that whole new British invasion thing in America. Mm-hmm. U2, Simple Minds, Echo and the Bunnymen, all those bands were all going over to America. There's a sort of circuit of clubs. We did that and came back, as I said, and did Top of the Pops. You two just stayed out there. They were out there. And we went back to America a couple of months later. They were still out there sort of touring. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mentioned this to you earlier, Glenn. We were in some club somewhere, and there was a little envelope, and it was to Julian Cope, the lead singer of our band, The Teardrop Explodes, from Bono, U2. Oh, that's interesting. We said, opened it up, and it's a little cassette back in the day, and it was just Bono singing, "This town ain't big enough for the both of us, but it ain't me that's gonna leave." You know, lots of love, Bono. You know. So, I mean, everybody was doing the same sort of stuff, and we did this double headline in New York. And
but you got to spend some time with Bono and things. And
we did have a bit of a chat. I mean,
Don't you want to hear what he's about to say? Like,
I think I should play the piano.
Okay, maybe play the piano. What's your next song?
This next song, I've been very, you know how Americans are really cool about, like, they've made transport really cool, like Route 66 and Take the A Train and all, Ventura Highway. So I've been trying to do my bit for the British roads. So this is a little tune I wrote, a little boogie, and it's called the M25 Boogie. And if you know the M25, you'll notice it kind of goes along quite well, then it sort of gets stuck and slows down a bit, and you're not sure what's going to happen. Then it sort of speeds up, and you get there in the end.
Brilliant. Go for it. Here we go.
Thank you.
10 the North Circular Road.
The B4365.
Sort of A to Z of music. Yes.
Very good. So you came into the band, The Teardrop Explodes, because, in a sense, it had already split by the time you entered into it.
Yeah. It was in its DNA to split a bit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sorry.
So, I mean, why do bands split? I mean, I guess it must be a very intense thing. You're sort of thrown together on the road. You're living in each other's pockets. What's it like on the road and all that?
Well, look, I think, to be honest, a lot of it comes down to kind of ego, how people deal with that, what people want from a certain situation. Look, I don't want to sort of get too much into the personalities, but Julian was the lead singer. I think by personality, he was more a sort of a solo artist mentality. I think he struggled in a way with sort of a band setup. So look, we mentioned U2. Well, I guess, look, Bono is kind of the main man, isn't he, in U2? But they work as a band, all the other guys, they're a tight unit.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Mick Jagger or something, look, he's the main man, isn't he? But I mean, him and Keith Richards and whatever, they work together. So I think Julian struggled a bit with that. So there was always a bit of tension about, you know, I want to do something different, and it just sort of slightly self-destructed, really.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a shame in some ways. I mean, there was a little band that sort of were on the up. I mean, I used to get fan letters. Do you believe that? People used to write to me. And people said, oh, we're so sorry to hear you've split up. I've just found a band called Duran Duran, and I think they're really quite good. You know.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
No, but hey, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, was that a massive blow to the ego? Was it kind of a...
Well, I think the weird thing for me at that time was it kind of left me in a bit of a... I wasn't too sure where I fitted into the scheme of things, as in, was I now a sort of established musician? Mm. Or do I ring the lads up with the pub band again and see what they're up to and say, look, sorry, guys, I'm back around again. You know, do you need a keyboard player? Mm-hmm. And around that time, because I mentioned I used to work in a press office for Polydor Records, a guy who sort of knew, oh, you know, Jeff, he joined the Teardrop Explodes. And then it was all, hey, it was in the music press. Teardrop Explodes split up and Jeff Hammer's left and Alfie's left and all this. He was working with some American guys who come over called the Stray Cats. I don't know if any of you remember them. And they were basically wanting a keyboard player and a sax player to tour with them in Britain and in Europe. Mm-hmm. I said, would you be up for it? And that was kind of on a session basis. You know, I mean, I was just going to be paid for the time and to rehearse and to play. So I did that. And I suppose that got me into what I suppose you'd now, you know, you call a session musician. I was working with bands. So I did that. I then, my dad used to have a butcher's shop in Oakwood. And he came out and he said, hey, the radio was on. There was some bloke from a band called ABC saying they're going to go and do a tour. Is that of any interest to you? So I said, oh, I could, yeah. So I got in touch. Did anyone remember ABC? Anyone? Yeah, you're all looking a bit young, actually. ABC had lots of hits. We did a whole sort of... So I then did that, and I got involved with Kim Wilde as well. She needed a keyboard player. So I started to do...
Yeah. So with all that... So what were some of your biggest gigs then in this era?
In this era. Well, Kim Wilde got the support... Michael Jackson recorded Thriller, which was, you know, one of the biggest albums ever, blah, blah, blah. He didn't actually tour Thriller. He then recorded the Bad album and did a tour, did a whole world tour with that. And when that came to Europe, Kim Wilde got the support slot on that tour. So we were opening, she was opening for Michael Jackson on the whole of that tour. I mean, they were all kind of football stadium tours. I mean, gigs. It sounds strange to hear it now, but, you know, if you're a promoter and you've booked, you know, the Olympic Stadium in Rome for 3 nights and you've got Michael Jackson on your bill, Kim Wilde was a pretty big artist in Europe. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, you know, it helps ticket sales to have somebody on the bill whose people will think, oh, it's really expensive to see Michael Jackson, but Kim Wilde as well. Okay, I suppose that's not
Jeff
bad.
Jeff Hammer, I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's just flocking. Flocking, Glenn.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, so we did that. And, I mean, that was, you know, football stadiums and...
What's that like? Like, you're on stage and tens of thousands of people are singing the songs and you're...
Well, the thing about doing that sort of thing is, if you're the support, I mean, I was fortunate in some ways. I didn't do too much support band work, but I mean, if you do a support gig at Hammersmith Apollo or something, when the support band's on, most of the people are in the bar, aren't they, basically? And then they come in and see the band. If you're at a football stadium, you can't be in the bar. Where are you going to go?
Right.
You've got to be there. So you play to the 70, 80,000 people or whatever is in the football stadium.
Wow.
It's obviously exciting. I mean, like the sound and the... There was a bit in one of the songs where, you know, you clapped and I was the guy who had to stand
there. Oh, yeah, of course. The keyboard player.
Yeah. And suddenly everybody's clapping along. Yeah, you know, and you say, hey.
Wow.
You know. So it is quite...
You're riding such a wave at that moment, aren't you?
Yeah.
Like, what is it? What, like, maybe now's the time to get into it. Like, what is the magic of music? You know, we kind of... You know, we kill things when we dissect them. So, like, you're not going to be able to kind of summarize it all. But what is it that we are tapping into when we're in this moment and hearing the music?
Well, I guess music definitely has an impact on everyone, doesn't it? I mean, I guess across this room, all of us would like different sorts of music. I guess we're all aware that music does different, you know, there's sad music and there's happy, at a party you will have happy music. At a sad occasion, you'd play somber music. And it affects us, doesn't it? It does have an impact on us. So I think on that very simple level, people are influenced by music. And there is a sense of enjoying something together. I think those big gigs, it's kind of a cultural... I mean, the sort of Michael Jackson thing was like a major... Every single city we went to, the whole place was just kind of focused in on...
Yeah,
you know, this has come to town, and this is where everyone's going to be that night. And that's fantastic.
Electrifying. Yeah, they often talk about sex and drugs and rock and roll kind of going together. In what ways do those temptations present themselves as a musician touring around?
Well, I guess, you know, that stuff is part of that sort of rock and roll world. It is there. There's no point pretending it isn't. Mm. I think for some people, I think some people almost feel that, you know, it's your duty bound to sort of, oh yes, I'm, you know, I mean, I've met people who genuinely kind of believe in rock and roll, you know, oh, man, we've got to be rock and roll. I mean,
Right.
There was a guy, I'm not going to mention his name, because probably some of you would know the band he used, anyway, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I was involved with something that he was playing with as well. And I mean, he genuinely kind of believed, oh, no, we can't do that. It's not rock and roll. I'm not going to... And, you know, his life was a mess. He'd had loads of success, lots of money. He'd wasted it all. He'd set fire to his Jaguar, and, you know, because it was rock and roll. No, that's just stupid. That's not rock and roll. Oh, but yeah, so I mean, that is there.
And how do you navigate that? We'll get onto your Christian faith in a minute. But how do you navigate that as a Christian? Were you known as a Christian in these situations, and did they just not bother to offer you the drugs or like what?
Yeah. Well, actually, all joking apart, there is an element. Hey, look, there's more for me. This, you know, we're not all going to do it. There's more. Because I guess I was 24, 25, perhaps we're going to talk about it. I'd been a Christian for a few years. When the thing started for me with the teardrop explodes, we sat there and I said, look, guys, I want you to know that I'm a kind of committed Christian. I mean, in case that's a problem, I mean, that's part. And Julian, the lead singer, he said, but you might be now, but you've not been part of a rock and roll band.
Right, yeah.
So the kind of view was, well, you know, it's probably something that will change when you kind of get involved in this. But having slightly contradicting that, I think at the same time, there is a sense in which, you know, you can be whatever. I was mentioning earlier that the bass player, he was one of these, I mean, fitness fanatics, because sometimes we used to share a room with him, and he'd be up at 6 a.m. and exercising, and, oh, can't you just go to bed, you know, sleep? You know, because, like, he's into that, I'm into taking acid, he's into reading the Bible.
You're not into taking acid.
No, just to be clear. That was someone else.
It was being someone else when he said he was.
No, not me.
Right, yes.
Different sort of things within, you know, and hey, that's the way it is, and you know, that's the way we are, and you do different stuff.
So they kind of respected you for that, in a sense?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it was a bit of a sticking point, I think, for Julian. I think it used to niggle him.
Right.
He wrote a biography about those times. Mm. And there's just slight references of, like, we had this tour manager who he said, you know, the tour manager used to wind up Jeff by rolling spliffs with his Gideon Bible in the hotels.
Right.
Well, it doesn't wind me, you know, there was this kind of, that's going to wind Jeff up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not me you've got to worry about, really, but, you know. And even a couple of years ago, Teardrop, we did some John Peel sessions and Richard Skinner sessions, and there was an album was repackaged, so all this stuff was, and there were some sleeve notes, some of which Julian had written a couple of years ago, and it talked about the fact after our lineup fell apart, they got another line, another keyboard player, and it said, and at least he wasn't reading the Bible all the time. And I thought, even all these years later, there was still this sense of, this guy who, there was something, you know, hadn't dropped that. Or, you know, we used to get on well, but we did get on well, but obviously there was something that was just, you know, hadn't forgotten that I was the, you know, and this thing of, we'll wind Jeff up.
You stuck out in that rock and roll world. I was going to suggest, why don't you, what's next?
What's next? Right. You know, if you play piano and stuff, you're probably supposed to say, you know, my influences are sort of Charlie Parker and Art Tatum and all the Miles Davis and all the jazz greats. Well, this influence I'm going to share with you is actually the Sound of Music. And this is my arrangement of a tune from the Sound of Music, which you might hopefully recognise. So, a little bit different. The Lonely Goat Herd. No. A few of my favorite things.
That's amazing. You really throw yourself in, don't you? Like, you're in it. You're in the song, aren't you?
I find it hard to be a little bit, to get totally involved.
What would it be like if somehow somebody took music away from you? I don't know if you went deaf or something. Oh. What would that do to you, like, emotionally?
The neighbors would be happy. it's obvious. I guess I've always felt it's maybe something, it's a bit of a gift I've been given. I learned to sort of play, but I guess being able to sort of do some of that stuff. My sister plays really nicely. She's a nice piano player, but take the music away,
right,
she's a bit lost. That stuff was something I could sort of do.
Yeah.
And I do feel it's a gift and... You know, I don't want to sound like old Eric Little when he was running or whatever. When I play, I do feel a sense of maybe I'm doing God's pleasure.
Yeah,
a sense of God's pleasure, yeah.
So the Chariots of Fire guy, he used to say, when I run, I feel God's pleasure.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something of what you feel?
Yeah, I don't want to get too poncy about that, but you know what I mean?
It would help my talk if you did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I really mean that.
Okay.
Do I need to go?
I might need to go. But if you want to keep on playing. So we're let's sort of bring things into the sort of the 90s. Tell me about sort of family life, because you met your wife kind of
at church doing the Pathfinder group, the youth, 10 to 14 year olds. She was, and there I was. She said I was the person who was never there, because who's this bloke who's always around whizzing off and never here? And
yes.
Was he in some band or other, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So throughout all this touring, if you're in a foreign country and it's a Sunday and you've got time off, did you ever,
find it? The Daily Mirror story.
Yeah, go on.
Well, talking about, when we were doing the Michael Jackson tour with Kim Wilde, my family live in Cot Fosters at the end of the Piccadilly line. So sometimes what I used to do is come back to Heathrow Airport, get the tube up to Cot Fosters, because you still have to do that sort of stuff. See my mum and dad, and they take me back to my flat in Barnet. You see, that all worked, ticked all the boxes. British Airways lost my luggage coming back from Ireland once, so I didn't have any bags. So I phoned up my mum and said, look, no point coming because I haven't got any bags. I'll just go back to Barnet. Mum said, have you seen the Daily Mirror? I said, no. And I said, I think you might want to go and buy the Daily Mirror. Okay, so I went and bought Daily Mirror, opened it up in the middle of the TV, entertainment section, half page, Kim Wilde finds true love. Read the article. Kim Wilde has found true love with her dark, handsome keyboard player, Jeff Hammer. What? There was a whole half page article. Jeff Hammer's been seen leaving her St. John's Wood flat. And Kim Wilde says, I've found blah, blah, blah.
So they put two and two together and came up with 300.
Well,
yes.
So that sort of happened. So, all right, this is interesting.
You've still got the clipping somewhere, don't you?
So I went home and I thought, okay, I went up to High Barnet and I had a flat in Barnet and I thought, all right, the press. So I came around the corner and I thought, okay, now look, if the photographers and stuff are there, what am I going to say? No comment. So I came around the corner and there was nobody there at all. So I just went home. Meanwhile, in the city, not Canary Wharf, in the city, in a bank that my future Mrs. Hammer, who wasn't Mrs. Hammer at the time, was my lady of significance. People sort of in the office that day, Claire, have you seen Jeff? is he? No, he's been on tour. Oh, all right. Have you haven't spoken? Oh, okay. Then someone else came up and said, Claire, have you spoken to Jeff at all? No, he's on... And then another person sort of came and sort of put the Daily Mirror on her desk and sort of sidled off.
Wow.
So that was kind of an interesting moment.
Yeah.
Although, look, it was quite a funny sort of thing, really. Kim's at it. It wasn't true, by the way. I had been seen leaving her St. John's Wood flat because we used to meet there.
Yes.
And often we'd be dropped off there after stuff. And, and I think because of my press office days, there were people who sort of knew and had sort of put to it. And look, Kim and I were good friends. She came to our wedding and we used to sort of look after her a bit when, you'd be seen to be. So I think also because of the whole Michael Jackson thing, everybody was obsessed with writing about Michael Jackson. So if you've run out of things to write about Michael Jackson, I know, we'll write about Kim Wilde, mm-hmm. and then we can also mention Michael Jackson.
Yes.
So,
yes.
yeah.
You're also on tour with David Bowie, is that right?
Yeah. Well, David Bowie, same sort of thing. He did a greatest hits tour at the end. It was about 1990, I think. Very different to Michael Jackson's tour. I mean, Michael Jackson's tour, you had to have passes. You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't go in the catering room unless you had a catering room pass and it was security. Whereas the first day we did the David Bowie tour, we played in Denmark. We arrived at this festival. There were these big cabins like for dressing rooms, and we arrived and we're sitting there, and suddenly there was knock on the door. You know, someone opened the door. In walks David Bowie. Oh, hello everyone. Hello Kim. Hello, you're Jeff. Oh yeah, you're Steve. Hi. How is it? Everything all right? Do you need anything? Have you got everything you need? And we were like, wow. You know.
Yeah.
Very different. He would stand on the side of the stage watching the show when we, you know.
There was such an outpouring when he died. Was that 2 years ago now?
I think it was.
Yeah. I mean, people really connected with him. He seemed to be, although he had many personas, people seemed to connect with something genuine in him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, I mean, I had some experience for a few months. I mean, he was certainly very sort of human and very easy. He didn't fly. So we were in Europe. So he, you know, his two or three tour buses would be at the front and we'd sort of follow on in our, and we had a tour bus as well, but it wasn't as big as his one. But you know, he'd sort of, oh, it was a long old journey today, wasn't it? And all this sort of stuff. So very, just, I think just relaxed in himself, happy to didn't it wasn't a problem for him chatting to these mere mortals in the support band, as it were, you know. I mean, he was fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So no, it's quite a privilege actually to, I was always a bit of a Bowie fan actually, so it's quite a privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, time's flying.
It has.
So do you wanna do Funny Valentine? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Go on. Tell us what you're doing next.
Okay. This is would be one of my all-time favourite. If I had to do Desert Island Discs, this tune would be one of my favourites. This is a Gershwin piece called My Funny Valentine. So this is my version. Here we go. Thank you.
Brilliant. So tell me about faith. You grew up in a Christian home, did you? Church going home?
Yeah, yes. I guess I was sort of packed off to sort of Sunday school when I was a kid. When I got to about 11, there wasn't really anything to do at the church for older than 11s. But because I played the piano, they said, oh, come and help with a little Tuddy's group and play the piano, which I didn't mind doing. It's quite fun, really. Mm-hmm. I've always thought about it in terms of it's as if I'm grateful to that church because it's as if they gave me jigsaw pieces. They gave me Bible stories, and I learnt things, you know, from the Bible and about who Jesus was and all this sort of stuff. But I think I'd been given the pieces, but the picture I'd made from those pieces, well, I guess it's all about sort of being a nice person. Right. So probably God wants me to be kind of nice, so I'll try and be nice. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about that was there was always someone around who was a lot worse than I was. So, I mean, I didn't get expelled or kicked out of the class, so I must have been, I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
Then I went along to another church. A friend said, oh, come up, church up the road, had a bit of a youth club in Cot Foster's, Christ Church, Cot Foster's. I don't know if anyone knows. End of the Piccadilly line, hey. The thing I noticed up there was that they kind of took the Bible seriously. They kind of seriously used to have meetings, and they'd always sort of, oh, the Bible, very serious about the Bible. And they kind of took Jesus seriously. They kind of, you know, what he said, and I thought, oh, okay, this was a bit different to me. Yeah. And I started to hear about the fact that actually it wasn't about sort of whether I was going to be a good enough person. I was starting to realize that actually if God was this sort of king of creation who was pure and holy, that actually I was never going to be good enough for him. And that's why they kept banging on about Jesus.
Right.
And so I remember, I think now a guy would have done a talk from the seven churches about Laodicea about you're not hot, you're not cold, you're lukewarm, and I'm going to sort of, and he talked about coffee. I remember this guy saying, look, you have iced coffee or you have cold coffee. You've got to kind of make your mind up. You've either got to walk away from this stuff or you've got to go with it. Mm-hmm. And someone had given me a copy of a book called Who Moved the Stone, which is that book about the resurrection a guy called Frank Morrison had written, who was going to write the definitive book, you know, I'm going to rubbish all this stuff about resurrection, and ended up becoming a Christian and writing this really mm-hmm. powerful book about the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And I think I realized that now I had a very different picture with those pieces, that I actually had to, it was something I had to either accept or walk away from. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was about 18, and I decided, yeah, I would make Jesus the sort of king of my life, and I was going to go with that. Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's.
And family, your parents, were they, you know, surprised that you were now taking this in a different direction, taking it more seriously than...
My parents, perhaps they'd been through a sort of similar process, and in a strange sort, they started to get drawn into Christ Church Cot Foster's as well.
Right.
And my big sister... My two younger brothers, not quite the same, not quite such a success story, but there you go. In fact, I kind of got confirmed, another story, with my dad, the two of us.
Oh,
we thought,
wow.
You know.
Yeah.
So I think the family got drawn in the same, and went through a similar sort of process. I remember rather sort of telling my mum, oh, you're not a Christian, because it was like, oh dear, you know, because I'd, a little bit of youthful views. Yes, yeah.
And all that.
But, yeah. So the Lord used that, I think.
And then how has that been an anchor? How has your faith in Jesus been an anchor through? Because I guess, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, there you were sharing the billing with you two, and they went stratospheric, and you went, you know, kind of, you know.
Yeah, easy. Don't rub it in.
You went to certain heights, but, you know.
Yeah.
But in one sense, that kind of fame, you almost think, like with somebody with like Michael Jackson, you think, gosh, fame can really mess you up. Right, like in one sense, you kind of dodge a bullet, but all those pressures coming on you. How has Jesus been?
I think. Look, in I guess God's sovereignty in terms of the timing of my life. I guess I always could. Look, I love music. I love the privilege of being able to play in the way. I mean, it is a privilege to be able to do what you kind of like to do, and it to be something that you can earn money with, and you're looked after and stuff. But I guess I always could see that you can't there's a difference between enjoying something and being committed, you know, participating to quite a sort of intense level with it, but actually building your life on it. Mm-hmm. I could always see through that. So as much like Julian's going, oh, you've not been in a rock and roll band yet. But actually, I think I always knew, look, yeah, but yeah, there are the highs, but there's also the morning after. And right. You can see the morning after as well. Right. And you can see the people who, you know, yes, they've got the highs, but actually you see them the next day as well when they're either so insecure that, you know, but what about the next single? I mean, this single's doing well, but if I want to, you know, how am I going to... There's that whole thing. There's a whole insecurity.
Yeah.
So... And often, I think like lots, I'm sure folk here who are committee members of this church, you'll know that folk don't always talk to you about your faith in the crowd, but in the quiet moments, mm-hmm. it's when someone says, well, yeah, that's quite, you know, that stuff about you, I don't know, tell us a bit about. Because mm-hmm. actually, away from the buzz and the, you know, I mean, there is that, was it, I don't know who said it, was it Bo Derek who said, you know, those who think money can't buy happiness don't know where to shop, you know, well, you know, there are some, there is great to whiz around and be taken around the world and get to see some nice stuff, but actually right. if you're building your life on it.
Yeah, you can't build a city on rock and roll.
No.
Contrary to the pop song.
Contrary to the song, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll need to wrap up this section in a second, but... So some people are here thinking about maybe investigating Jesus further. Why should they do that? And how should they do that?
Why should they do it?
Yeah.
Well, because I guess if you're like me or like the way I was, there's no point in a sense having Jesus as someone who's kind of a nice example around, and I'll try and kind of, if that's the Jesus you have, then you need to either investigate whether the claims he made for him, because he didn't say I'm a nice person. He kind of said, look, I am God and I do the stuff that God does, and accepted the worship of people. And now, I mean, it was C.S. Lewis, wasn't it, with his sort of mad, bad or God. You know, either he's, you know, a nutter or, you know, he's could well be who he says he is.
Right.
So... But I would say that kind of the middle ground, like the guy who talked about lukewarm coffee, you know, it's no good to anybody. It's no good to anybody.
Right.
So check it out. How do you do it? Well, you come to a jolly good church like this one here. You might want to read your Bible and sort of read the Gospels and sort of meet the guy in that. But all joking apart, I guess it would be a good idea to go somewhere where perhaps they can open the Bible up with you and give you a chance to engage with it. I'm certainly grateful for those back when I was a teenager who were very, as I said, were pretty serious about this Bible stuff and took time out. You know, I can remember a guy in a sort of youth camp. I don't even remember the guy's name, you know, but he just spent quite a lot of time with me on that youth holiday, you know, explaining stuff to me.
Yeah.
I don't even remember his name.
Yeah, but we do need each other, don't we? It's a team sport, and do get hooked in. This is a great place to get engaged with Jesus. We've got a real treat now, don't we? Because you're going to play...
A hymn?
Time to play a hymn.
Go on, then.
Right. This is a hymn. This is a hymn written in the 1800s. And it's a hymn that says, what a friend we have in Jesus. Do you want to do this? It's a hymn that says, what a friend we have in Jesus. I guess tying in with what I've just said, I guess a lot of people wouldn't necessarily think that you can, if Jesus is God, the creator of the universe, he can actually be your friend. He's interested in us and interested in each of us. That's a pretty special thing. A guy wrote this hymn in the 1800s. I don't think he necessarily would have heard it quite like but you know.
you so much, Jeff. Stick around, because we might have a final song or a final couple of questions for you to answer. But let's just think as we close about music and why it is that it connects so deeply with each of us. Have you ever gone on YouTube? There's a very interesting video there where the Star Wars Episode 4, do you know the end of Star Wars Episode 4? And they're all walking down this big aisle, and everybody's there because they're about to receive these medals. And it's this big scene, and Chewbacca is there, and Luke, and Leia is offering everybody the medals. It's this exultant scene. And everybody's there to celebrate together. But this video on YouTube, what it does is it strips away John Williams' score, right? And it's utterly silent. And it's the weirdest thing you've ever seen. It's just these people walking down. And every now and again, you hear someone go... People shuffling awkwardly. And Luke Skywalker is beaming like a fool. And you strip the music out of it. And it's rubbish. It's total rubbish. And then this video, it puts John Williams' score back in. And it is exultant, and you're punching the air, and you've got goose pimples all over you. What is music? It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing how it connects with us so emotionally. And as we finish, I just want to ask the question, why do you think that is? Why do you think we connect on a profound level with music? Well, our way of answering that question is by picking up John's Gospel. You should have a copy of this on your table. Why don't you pick up this little pink book? If you don't know what this is a biography of Jesus, written by one of Jesus' great companions, John. And I just want to draw your attention to one sentence, and it's on page 43 of this, page 43. It's the night before Jesus dies. Jesus is praying before the Father, and he is explaining to you why music gets you right here, okay? Jesus is going to explain that to you. Here we go, page 43, and you see three quarters of the way down the page, there's a little number 24. That means it's verse 24 of chapter 17. Jesus is praying to the Father in front of a whole bunch of people, and he says, Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory. The glory you've given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. Now that's quite a thing to say. Jeff's just said, you can't think of Jesus as just a good teacher. You know, C.S. Lewis said that a man who makes these sorts of claims, he's either mad or he's bad or he's God. A man who says that I was there before the universe began, such a man, what do you want to do with such a man? You either have to section him, or you have to arrest him, or you have to worship him. There's no other thing you can do with Jesus, given that he claims to be older than the universe. What are you going to do with this guy, Jesus? He says he was there before the world began, and you might want to ask him, Jesus, what was that like? And he says it was love. Before the foundation of the world, there was a father who was constantly loving him. Is that your picture of before the world began? It's quite an odd thing to think about, isn't it? Before the world began, if you kept hitting rewind on this world and you went back and back and back and back before people, before planets, before protons, what is there? Jesus says there's love. There is a Father loving him, the Son, in the joy of the Holy Spirit. In a sense, there is harmony. Before the world began, there is harmony. You know, what is harmony? You've got this triad, don't you? A major chord. We know what a major chord is, isn't it? Right? Major chord, 1, 2, 3. And yet there's this profound unity together. And the Bible speaks of these three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, united together in perfect love. Before there was a world, there was music. Before there was a world, there was harmony. And out of harmony has been birthed a world which is intended to share in the glory of this God. Notice Jesus uses this word glory. It's the throbbing bass note that just sort of hums along underneath all things in this world. There is music behind and before and beneath this world, and we are intended to participate in this glory, to be part of this great harmony. But there's a problem. Do you see the next verse? It says, Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you. That's a shocking thing, isn't it? So Jesus says he and the Father are in harmony by the Holy Spirit, and yet he says that the world is somehow out of harmony. There's discord
in the world, and perhaps you've felt it. You've felt the discord that is out there in the world. And it's all very well me talking about love and light and life, and it's all very well me talking about a major chord of great harmony, but you're going to tell me, look, I live in a world that's full of discord. I live in a world that's full of disharmony, right? You feel it and I feel it. But the Bible's got a shocking answer to the question, why is there disharmony in the world? The Bible says the reason there's disharmony in the world is because there's disharmony in me. I came to a fresh realization of this truth just 1 month ago. 1 month ago, I was preaching in a church down in Eastbourne. It's not my usual church. And this music group that were playing at this church, none of them were of the caliber of Jeff. Quite far from that, to be honest. They were keen, probably too keen at points. And I found myself as this visiting speaker just sort of trying to send telepathically a thought to the guy on PA, just saying, whoever that singer is, turn him down. And I meant this in the most original sense of the phrase. I meant, for the love of God, shut him up, right? And I was just thinking this constantly. And it got so bad that in the final hymn, I was just thinking, shut him up. And then something in me made me want to look down. There's some part of my subconscious just awoke. And I got this massive urge to look down to my lapel, where I saw my microphone. And then to my transmitter with the light still on. And I realized that the cacophonous voice was mine. I was so concerned about all the discord that was out there. Shut him up! And it was me all along. So I switch off my microphone, and instantly the sound in the room improves by about 400%, you know. And I think this is what the Bible wants to say about you and I. You know, we look out at a world that's very discordant, right? We look out at a world that is sort of out of harmony. And the Bible says, yeah, before you point the finger at everybody else, like, check your own microphone, right? Figure it out. There was a great Christian thinker called Francis Schaeffer. I'm going to update his illustration. He used an illustration about tape recorders. I'm going to update it and say it's about apps. He said, imagine that you've got an app on your phone. And let's call it the iJudge, okay? And this app on your phone, whenever you make a judgment about somebody else and you say how the world should be, if you ever use the phrase he ought or she should, if you're ever driving down the road and you think everyone who drives faster than you is a maniac and everyone who drives slower than you is an idiot, right? As you make these judgments of the world, the iJudge app just records every single judgment you ever make. Can you imagine it? Just dozens every week. Thousands every year, hundreds of thousands in a lifetime. And then Francis Schaeffer said, can you just imagine on the last day God retrieving all those recordings and just playing all those judgments? You'd be guilty as hell, wouldn't you? You'd be condemned by your own sense of justice. And Francis Schaeffer said, even before you look at the Ten Commandments, by your own standards, you are a cacophonous mess, right? You are discordant. The reason why the world is so messed up is because of you and me. We're out of harmony. And that's why the world is full of these minor key songs. You know, you go through, so the major key, you know, this, and then the minor key, right? These minor key songs. So all of a sudden it's sad, isn't it? And you read through the Bible and there are these minor key songs in the book of Psalms. Do you know the Psalms? This songbook of the church, written 1,000 years before Jesus came in the flesh. And the number one song, the number one kind of song in the Psalms are Psalms of lament. Psalms where people talk about the darkness. People talk about their disconnection from God. They're walking through the valley of the shadow of death. All these minor key songs. But then what does God do about that? God looks at a world that has fallen into a mess, but he is love. He's a fountain of love. So what does he do? Well, love joins you in the pit, doesn't it? If you're in a pit, what does love do? Love dives down into the pit and says, your pit will be my pit. And so here we go. We've got Jesus, the second member of the triad, and he falls down. And now all of a sudden he is singing the minor key songs. What is Jesus doing as he walks through the Gospels? He is this man of sorrows. And one of the things Jesus is always doing is he's always taking the Psalms onto his lips. He's always singing these Psalms of lament. And he takes them all the way to the cross. And even on the cross, he is praying these sad songs, these minor key songs, these Psalms of lament, and saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? What's he doing? He's taking on the discord, right? He's entering into the cacophony. He's entering into our sad songs and singing them as one of us, and taking that punishment that we deserve for having fallen from God, from not wanting him. And there is Jesus entering into our minor key. And then what does he do on Easter Sunday? On Easter Sunday? He rises. And all of a sudden, the major key again. And what does Jesus do? Here's the offer. Beautiful verse, isn't it? Jesus says in verse 24, Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory, the glory you've given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. What does Jesus want? He wants to bring you in on the harmony, doesn't he? He wants to bring you in on this family of love. And if you say yes to Jesus, you say no to the discordant notes, you say sorry for that, you say yes to Jesus, and you're brought into this love song. And suddenly you get Jesus as Father as your Father, you get his Spirit as your Spirit, you get his future as your future, and now you can sing. Sing with Jesus. Sing with the living God. Why do we love music? It really does plumb the depths of our human experience, doesn't it? Music really does that. But the reason it does that is because there is a God of harmony. You and I, we're full of discordant notes. We're full of disharmony. But Jesus enters into that to offer us again fellowship with the living God, to come in on this love story, to come in on this love song. Can you say what Jeff just played for us? What a friend we have in Jesus. If you can say that, then you'll sing forever.